be able to introduce you to history and education website. We were very, very pleased when the Institute for Historical Research agreed to give us additional funding to that already supplied by the Lindbury Trust to enable us to put all these wonderful resources on the web for anybody, any researcher, any interested person to look at. Today, we're going to take you on a short tour of the website, and so doing, I hope to entice you to explore it for yourself at your leisure. There's an enormous amount there, and we're only going to highlight some of the findings today as they're illustrated by the resources. For the same, I think the lighter things rather than the heavyweight controversies that have been referred to earlier. But I just want to make a little warning beforehand and to say that there's about a third more resources to go up. I've still got some interviews to put up, I've still got some more schoolwork to put up, and it's just the time that it's taken to load all these things up, it's quite complicated. So it's a work in progress. It will all be finished by Christmas. So I would say, if you visit now, great. Visit again after Christmas and we'll be even more there. So I'm going to dispense with this when I get the scan. Please bear with me. What's going on? There we are. There will be a little bit of sort of technical changing around, and I have obviously tried these things, but I hope we're going to get the schoolwork, etc. Okay. So here's the website front page. Some of you know we've been looking at it already. Just point to the two graphics. The two graphics that we've got on the page, which were photographs that were sent to us by some of our respondents. And I really want to say a big thank you to hundreds of people who supplied these to us for this website. Here we have a traditional photograph in the classroom supplied by Mr. Geddes, who's in the photograph from the 1920s. And I think it does set in context the traditional view of how history was taught with the children in Surrey, where it was listening to the teacher talking. And at the top, we've got a rather nice photograph here supplied by Mrs. Siebel of herself in costume there in Pageant in the 1930s. And there's another side of the history. You can draw it back into the past. Children recreating things. In 1930s, we reconstruct the history for ourselves. And living it, getting into living it. And I think that's something that's become a real theme in the 20th century. So there is plenty of text on there, which I'm not going to go through, which explains the project. But of course, like all other websites, we've got the various areas that we can have. We have a browse the data page, which I hope will come up. And this allows you to see the main forms of data that we've gathered. We have the surveys. Now, originally, we had to get together in all the history archive and decide how to do it. And developing a survey was the way to do it, the way into finding our volunteers. We wanted to have a spread of people from across the country, a spread of age groups, a spread between teachers and pupils, and we'd heard that a survey would get people to be interested in just filling a little bit of information about themselves, and that would then give us an introduction to themselves, and we could pick up those people we wanted to interview. We'll be showing a few of those later on. We then moved on to the interviews, and I won't click onto those yet, but the interviews, obviously, we've got 68 interviews involving 80 people, which is quite a good number, I think, and across the whole range of people with different experiences within history. We have included former secretaries of state, HMIs, teacher trainers, as well as teachers and pupils. We have schoolwork, and this was an unexpected bonus, in that sometimes we contacted people who were filling the survey book. They wrote in on the survey book, I have my old school exercise books. Or projects that are done at school. And that was great because we hadn't expected that. And we've got about 25 different collections, all photographed, which will be going on site, and some of them are there today. And then we also collected, data on examinations, for instance, which we included in other educational data. So that's sort of the raw material that was built up of the project. And we then worked with that in preparation for the book, by actually processing all the sequence it was saying. But obviously we were reading in the background as well. So we actually developed various project papers which we've put on the website as well. For instance, the presentations. These were, if I click onto presentations now, so we've got some newspaper headlines. History's never out of the news, but in the past couple of years it's been more so than ever in the news. We attended various conferences over the 2.5 years that we've been doing the project. And I put on all the presentations, all the PowerPoint presentations, many of which have notes attached. So if you want to catch a flavour of how the whole idea is developed. You can see this through the various presentations that we have on the website. In addition to that, we then wrote them up into various project papers. Now, some of them we put into topic papers, and here I've listed the sort of topics that we were covering. We did papers on government policy and the curriculum, obviously, to get the backdrop. We did papers on examinations, on teacher numbers and teacher training, on textbooks and technology. So they're all there for those who are interested. And then we wrote those up into what might be called a history of school history. And these were the sort of background draft papers, fully formed analysis, that then Daly was able to use to inform the draft of the book. Some of them were there already. You can see I put 65 to 88, 88 to 2010, but there will be others to go up that we haven't done within the 1900 to 65 period. So that's a quick tour of that aspect. So we've got the data, we've got the project papers. We're going to have a page on conference, so there's not much there at the moment. We're going to have the video, the podcast, the photographs of today, and you're all here. We have got an archive page. Now, obviously, we've collected not only the oral evidence, we've got the transcripts of the interviews, we've got donated teaching materials, actually, and quite a few original documents that teachers have given us. And pupils have given us. We have some work that's been donated to us. All of those things will be going to the Institute of Education, which is kindly agreed to host our archive. In addition to that, all our interviews are going to be available on the British Library's website in their sound archive, and all the transcripts will be available. You will be able to link through, I've done the link already to the British Library website and to the Institute of Education archive catalogue. Obviously, it's going to be sometime after 2012 when those are going to be available when we wound up the project. So that will be a way in which the website obviously will continue, but you can follow it up further. And then finally, I've done a page of links. Now, I must say, we've just been supported by a huge web network of people who are involved in various organisations that are interested and supportive of history education in schools. So I've started to put on their various websites. I mean, chief among them at the Historical Association, who supported us throughout and given us access to their branch members, to their conferences, to advertise the project and to help us find contacts. And also the School's History Project, likewise, who supported us throughout, given us access and information and contacts, which without these two particular organisations we would have found. I've included other websites such as Derek Gillard's. This is an excellent website if you want the background of the history of education in England. I've included the school history websites. I mean, some of these are marvellous. This is just a school website, but it's got a marvellous amount of information. So to anyone who's sort of searching for history websites, Spartacus, of course, many of you will use Spartacus loads of times. It's brilliant for teachers as well as for school pupils. So I'll put those on, and then I put some of the specialist teachers' websites on. I mean, obviously people from the Institute will recognise this one, the Holocaust Education Development Programme, the school history. Masses of information out there on the web for teachers to use. So you get just a little insight into the different facilities and resources that are available. Even this is a drama group, this theatre production. So I thought they were all interesting. Okay, that is a quick tour of the website, and I'm sure you can all explore it. But what I'm going to do for the rest of this presentation is to look at some of the data so you can see the quality and range of what we've gathered. Coming on to the surveys, we've got a lot of information on the survey website. And what we did was, obviously you've got, it's doing this download, hopefully get it up. This was the original survey form, which some of you here will have filled in. This is the pupil one. And as you can see, it does ask for quite a lot of detail. So we were very pleased when we got over 200 responses to this. 206 people offered to fill the whole thing in. And some of them are considerable. And it developed into, I think, a way of doing a little memoir on the school days. And we got some fascinating information in these boxes, filled in either by hand or electronically. And the nice thing about the electronic responses, it can go on for pages. You can just expand the boxes. And I know one person wrote 10 pages electronically. So I think that was a teacher, to be honest, and covering a whole career. So, but it's great. So we were able to gather information from those that was a formal evidence in itself, beyond and above the oral history archive. So we then had to think what we did with all that information. And what we actually decided to do was to summarise it. What we did was break it down into decades of birth. That allowed us to get a picture of the education that the pupils were experiencing at particular times in the century. So you could see what British primary school was like in the 1940s, the 1950s and 1960s as the decades moved through. And likewise with the teacher surveys, we were able to see their careers at different stages. So teachers who started teaching in the 50s, started teaching in the 60s, you could see the sort of differences in their approach. So I'm going to do a little illustration from these and show you one or two of them. So if I go into pupils born 1910s to 40s and their primary school memories, very easy to get these up. We have anonymised these, and you can see where people have been interviewed, and the first, on the key, you've got the initial of the people. So you can actually go to, I think that's John Gates there, you can actually go to his interview. But here we've got from his survey form. I'm going to go down to, picked out JC, born 1924, which is just down here. We started to learn history in 2A, this is in Oxford. They are both coloured books obtainable at educational stores and Woolworths for sixpence. They would each cover an era, Anglo-Saxons, Picts, Norsemen, etc. And data of warriors, methods of transport, land and sea. These could be coloured with pencils and paints. So, I mean, it's just a nice picture of how primary school children were learning history at that time. But they still had exams. We had exams at the end of term, I think we had reports. So, did you have Maypoles or Guy Fawkes Nurse? It's giving you a nice flavour of primary education. And each one is telling you about primary education for people born in the 20s. It's a nice, complex picture of what they were learning. So, just get rid of that. Now let's look at primary school members in the 1980s. So, if we go on to the 1980s one, I picked out LH from 1982. And I'll get a picture there about primary school history. Well, 1982, that's in the late 80s, though, just before the national curriculum came in. So, at my second primary school, Shropshire, history teaching was excellent. We studied the ancient Egyptians, which included constructing a pyramid from sheets in the school hall, into which we invited our parents to eat Egyptian food, view our artwork, and other displays. The project must have lasted at least one term, all from the ancient Egyptians. So, somewhat different approach to the first one. Lots of imagination going into both of them, actually, one of the coloring books, etc. But here we have a project approach, and same with the Victorians. So if you read about pupils born in the 1980s, you get a similar flavour of what it was like to be a primary school studying history then. We did so much on the second sector that we had to split it up into different themes. So I go down to pupils with it, as you can see, we split it into textbooks, syllabuses, aids, outings, activities. I just turn to what? Where have I got him? Pupils born 1950s to 90s. Ooh, skipping things now. Okay, then. And skipping me. How we were taught. So this is pupils born in the 50s first. They're all in chronological order. And you can just. Here we are, AF, 1954, went to grammar school in Hull. And at grammar school, I remained interested in history, almost despite the teaching, which even at the time seemed boring. And I remember Mr. Punchard being highly innovative and getting us to work in groups, produce newspapers and tutor times. Things got slightly between O-level and A-level classes, but not due to teaching. So obviously the newspaper was a little hiatus of interest between. But he's how we were taught in the classroom, there was a lot of copying off the board. To be unstead books. If we're lucky, we've got to draw that diagram. So not a great positive view of grammar school teaching. In fact, we have got quite a lot of evidence that second grammar schools were more inventive, where the teacher wasn't tied to the O-level syllabus, and pupils were doing far more interesting things in the second and others. So all this sort of flavour came out with the evidence there to back it up. So it was a work of building up from on all these memories. And this survey evidence, I think, it adds a lot of depth to the interviews. You can all say an interview is an anecdote, but to have this amount of background information from people, enough people's memories, this is 100 surveys and 206 people surveys. That's a lot of people from all over the country. I was going to say, we've got right back teachers born in the 1920s. So these are people who started teaching in the 1950s. In fact, our oldest teacher interview started teaching in the late 40s. So it's great to have a complete run through to the modern day. We interview teachers who are teaching today in schools. So teachers born in the 1920s. I picked out PC born 1922. Perhaps I've not got the right one there. As members have been taught this, my apologies. But yes, it's that one I want to. There we go. So it's very easy to get these up and to look through them. Obviously, you might just want to dip into it sometimes. Serious research will, of course, use a whole lot. But if you just want to dip in just to see what people are saying. So PC opens at the top, born 1922. You can see what he or she was learning. Taught at a secondary model school and grammar school. So year one, Stone Age, the fall of Rome. Year two, Middle Ages. Year three, Tudors and Tuarts. Year four, 18th century to 1815. Very traditional syllabus. And his approach, as it was tied to a strict syllabus, I had to cover the periods. I taught more or less conventionally. That is to say, each lesson began with a return of homework, which meant a repetition of ground covered, followed by an exposition by me, during which pupils took notes. I tried to make lessons interesting by involving the class as far as possible, asking questions, throwing in red herrings, or calling on individual pupils to take over on prepared topics. So there's some involvement there going on. So it's quite nice in the 50s that teachers were making the most of that. They did have a lot of aids to help them, just the blackboard and themselves and a textbook each year. So that's a review of the survey evidence, which is all in the background there. I'm going to move on to look quickly at the schoolwork. The service is really, really engagingly attractive. Some of it isn't, it's just reams and reams of notes. But we haven't uploaded all of it yet. But we've got a great variety from the A-level history notes from the 1980s, with cartoons on them, I have to say. Time charts and history topics, GCSE notes from the very recent history exercise books from the 1970s. As you can see, I think the earliest here are the 1940s. So I'll go down to Monica's books from the 1940s. Oh dear, have you got that? I think it may have flipped up. I'm going to just get back to that. History books. That's it. And this is the first year history book from a girls' grammar school in North London. And I've just waited to load up. Now, these are huge files because we photographed every page of this exercise book. And once it's loaded up, I'll show you a little bit of Monica's work. And one of the nice things is the illustrations that children put into their books. And you can see exactly what syntheses that they're following and the sort of work they're doing. Let me see if I can make that somewhat bigger for you. Visible to most people? There, that's about the largest I can make it. Just take you a little bit through it. You see that there's some unusual things coming here. She's got a story of bread. That was one of the first things we did. Obviously started with grains in the age of whoops, ancient civilization. So she's got Mesopotamia and development of grains. And moving on, I think she comes to the Greeks. So very traditional in that sense, but then interspersed with these rather nice thematic ideas, the story of writing. So quite an imaginative curriculum, bringing some themes through time and a chronological approach. And really beautifully illustrated by Monica, aged 11 in 1947, I think. So, and she's got some nice collage on trade and industry. So that's a very nice example of a beautiful notebook, and that she sent us all her notebooks, so we've got a lot of them. That's fine. So that's from the 1940s. I'm going to skip through to the 70s and show you something from the 70s. Go back to the schoolwork. And now this one we did use in the book as
This is Jim and Andrew's primary school project, school trip to the castle in 1977, where Jim was 7. And it's a lovely little book, nicely illustrated, and gets a load of it. It's a bigger one, because again, I'll make it slightly bigger. There we go. So it's not as close as I would like, but on your own screen, it should be somewhat bigger. You can see the writing, very rarely. She starts off with After the Dinosaurs. So this is After the Dinosaurs. So she's going to do castles, but she's starting at the very beginning of history. She moves through a quick run through, focusing on huts. The teacher was obviously focusing on where people lived. And they prepare for their trip to Warwick Castle. Ladders coming in here. And the Vikings attacking York, probably. And then we get towards castles. And she gets through to her, she's got King Harold there. And the 4th of May, 1977. On Tuesday, May 3rd, we travelled by coach to visit Warwick Castle in the rain. We saw the curtain walls and the towers built on the top of a hill and thought of knights on horse. Sorry, horse, hoff, horse, she can't decide. Horseback. And then she's gone to a quite small place. She was a bit in the drawbridge. So there's a beautiful illustration of the visit. There it is. And there's the castle with the drawbridge. So it gives a really nice impression of the sort of imaginative work that children were doing in the 70s. And trips became a real feature, actually, from the 70s and 80s. And I think it's connected with schools having a bit more money available during that time. And you do get quite a lot of evidence of projects and trips. So that was Gillian's work. I'm going to bring back. And then just finally, I want to pick out another change in history, which is illustrated in children's work. Final one, and this is from a much more recent one, and this person decided they want to remain anonymous, but it's from a comprehensive school in the northeast of England. Again, it's beautifully illustrated, and this one's rather large, isn't it? But I'll go down a little bit and see how it goes. It's loading. Thank you for bearing with me on this. There we are. And I'll make it a little bit smaller. Right, we're not going to look at that page, but I'll continue down. And this is the 1990s. After the international curriculum come in, we've got the French Revolution, which is year 8, it's on the curriculum. And reasons for the French Revolution, financial reasons, quite a lot of notes, actually very similar in some ways to earlier in the century, the events of the revolution. So she's written those up. Excellent work. The execution of Louis. Am I going too fast? And then she moves to Tudor times. One of the issues that we did find is that much more focus on change and continuity on the concepts. I was looking actually for the page where she does sources and evidence, and I'm afraid I'm trying to get through, and I can't. She's got the religious helter skelter there. Right. So you can see how the teacher's following it. Okay. So that's the school work, and there will be a lot more of that. Now, we're going to move on to the interviews and have some little clips from those, which I think illustrates some of the... Oh, I'll just mention the edited highlights, actually. That's a page where we've gathered together a selection of quotations from the interviews. The interviews are mainly half an hour to an hour and a half long. It's a long time. You have to go through the transcript to find anything, although, of course, you can use the search and find. But what we did was we did little collections of quotations from them. And so you can see themes of, say, people's views on the national curriculum, wanting to be a history teacher, why have you decided to be a history teacher? Technology, there are all sorts of issues. And also to mention that you can use these sidebars to actually, if I go on to, I'll go back to the interviews actually to show that. And the interviews, you can use these topics. So for instance, if I wanted everything on the 1930s, it would gather up everything on the 1930s. I will be doing more tagging to enable that to happen. So you'll know that all these people in these interviews talk about the 1930s, and these pieces of work are from there. And if you say you wanted the 70s, there's the 70s. Or you wanted the national curriculum, there we are. Or GCSE. So that's a way also you can search on the website, and I will be tagging more. Okay, so I'm going to transfer over to Jenny. I'm going to attempt to call up the interviews. We'll do a few clips. And she wanted to start with Kenneth, who's in our audience today. I hope he's not embarrassed that he's choosing his to start with.
I'm just going to say a little bit first about
this. Yes.
Are you going to stay here, Susan?
Yes, I will.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I've been concentrating on organising this conference, so I've left all of this basically to Nicola, who's the expert on the website, and has done a wonderful job working with one of the people in IHR who knows about inputting stuff onto the web. First, I would just like to pay tribute to all the people who took part in the project. For me, one of the most rewarding aspects of working on it was particularly interviewing former pupils, whom I think there are a few in the audience today. Many of the people I interviewed were in their 70s, 80s, and even 90s. And most of these contacted after a letter I wrote to Saga magazine was published, which I think is going to be on the website as well. Or is it already?
What, the letter?
The letter.
Well, anyway. I haven't put it on yet.
Saga magazine.
Yeah.
The website's a work in progress. I don't know if it's something about Saga magazine readers, but I was absolutely overwhelmed by the vitality and the life-enhancing interest and enthusiasm of the people that I interviewed. Many of them had led hard, difficult lives, but what all had in common was a continuing desire to try new things and be engaged in new projects like ours. So they were happy to have a total stranger arriving on their doorstep and going into the intimate details of their history lessons. Unlike many of our younger respondents from the 1940s, 50s and 60s, these were not by no means all from grammar schools. They came from an era when over 90% of children left school at 14. And many of them did too. And even if you went to grammar school, you usually left at 15 or 16 in those days. Some, like Mrs. Marion Clark, still regretted, who's now over 80, still regretted leaving school a week after her 14th birthday. She was proud of her children and grandchildren who'd all gone to university and beyond, but she still longed to have studied the Victorians and not just to have stopped at the Tudors. And then there was Ernie Dodge, who was working down a mine by the time he was 14. At his elementary school, they were beaten if their mark in the weekly history test went down from the week before. So naturally, the boys all engineered it so they never did too badly, but never ever got full marks, because then they could only go down at some point and get beaten. There are so many stories in these interviews, even though we were just talking about history teaching. I'm going to give you a couple of clips, or Nicola is, we hope, from some of our tapes. But anyway, first I'd like to thank all these people who gave up their time and energy to talk to me. And truly, I enjoyed every minute of meeting you all. Right. The first one that we've included was of Kenneth Kelsey. Did he come today?
Yes, yeah, there.
Right. Ken came from a poor family in East London, but passed the scholarship exam at 11 and went to Raines Foundation School for Boys in Stepney.
Sorry, it's coming through already.
Oh. Right. He really enjoyed his history lessons, but was taught in a very traditional way and only learnt about... The only period he learnt at school was 1485 to 1815, the period that he was eventually examined on for school certificate, the equivalent of GCSE today.
So we'll hear a bit from Ken. I hope this is... I don't know if this is the right place, just a minute. No, it's not. I'll have to move it on again. Right, so we're going to start partway through Ken's interview, if I can get it in the right place. There. About there. Can I do it? No.
Can we follow? Yeah. Reports. I see that I used to do that in... printed letters rather than script, so that the revision on the back guys other thing that he
he's talking about his history.
They learned our heart for the dates of the monarchs and two bull points for that period. So, for example, I remember Edward VII, 1485, 1509, Star Chamber, foreign marriages. Anyway, 1509, 1547, wars in power, breach with Rome. And the idea was that if we went into the exam room with those bullet points, it didn't matter what the question was, we knew the salient features of that monarch's reign. And clearly, the aim was to get us to pass the exam. And looking back on it, I think that's one of the criticisms that I have about history. We were taught to pass the exam in history. Not for having one to understand the subject, but 1485 to 1850, we didn't have to answer any question that was given to us.
Is Bill Endersby, who went to Catford Central School in South East London. He was taught history in a very innovative way in the 1930s. It was called Lines of Development, where themes were studied across the centuries. He was 90 when I interviewed him, but he still vividly remembered these lessons and loved the way he'd been taught. He was one of the... He was one of the few pupils of his school who stayed on an extra year to do school certificate when he was 15. So suddenly he had to revert to learning history the traditional way, which he found an enormous culture shock.
I don't recall we had many textbooks for this, you know. We must have had some. But in general, it was off the blackboard.
Right.
We would start, the object of the lessons was to deal with particular subjects like clothing, transport, and so on, and to take them right through from the beginning of time, through to modern times. So you got your clothing, started off with bone possibly, skins. Ran through the early years and always went through the Industrial Revolution, the spinning jelly and Hargreaves loom and all that sort of thing. I still remember this. I don't recall we had many textbooks for this.
Okay,
show. We must have had some.
That's me, actually. I think that was the end of the talk. So.
Well, we've got a way to go on the technology, but it will be working, and I hope you found that interesting. And now I'm going to give you back to Nicola, who's going to look at the teachers.
Yes, I was going to try to teach. Sorry about that. I think I just was hovering over it and it reversed. Do we want to allow time for a few questions? Okay, so I won't do a lot on the teachers. I'll just do... just a couple, actually. Let's see. This is going right back. Our oldest teacher that we interviewed, Mr. Michael Hinton. And he was talking about when he first started teaching at Reading Grammar School and in the late 40s. And he was a young new teacher, just out of training college, and looking for some good advice. And unfortunately, he didn't have a very easy time of finding that advice. But
Michael Hinton. What were the ideas?
So when you actually got into the classroom, how long did it take you to become confident and start using some of these new ideas?
My first job was at Reading School, which was a grammar school. It was a state grammar school, but it was very like a public school. In fact, I think it was actually on the Advances Conference, or had been. And it was the easiest school I ever taught in. And I can remember they had asking the head of history some question when I went there. He said, Hinson, I teach as I see fit, you teach as you see fit, we have nothing to say to each other. Each teacher is king of his classroom, and of course, he's all fit. And that actually helped me enormously because I was able to do things that my colleagues would have shrunk from doing.
But you were fortunate. Sorry, yeah, so you see how it was. It wasn't all this collaboration, you just had to get on with it. So that's the late 40s. Just going back to the interviews. Nice one to I have to say, one of the really entertaining interviews was John D. Clare. I don't know if you know John, but he's a raconteur, really great storyteller and very entertaining. And so I had a very entertaining interview. And he told me about his starting with teaching in the 70s. And how he got a reputation as being somewhat technologically advanced because he could manage a film strip. And not many of the other teachers could do. I'll just play that little bit, which is.
Capacities to need your computers active. And you use those quite a lot. It's quite a skill to be able to thread through. I remember being invited into the classroom of the teacher next door. So he was showing one of these real movies, and he said, "John, there seems to be something wrong with this." And he managed to thread it through the machinery, forgot to attach it onto the wind-on spool at the back. So it was just sort of pouring out of the back of the machine, and he'd been sort of having children collecting it in their hands as it came through. And by the time it reached four children with their hands full of movie and real. I became quite famous at my school because I knew how to set up, I forget even what were those things called, the two little windy things, and it had kind of a reel of pictures on there. On the
radio vision.
It was sound. It was just a film strip, and sort of what you had this kind of box thing with these two windy things, and you had to be upside down but right way around, and then you could really look through. And then so that was the Brighton man, this Brighton man in school, and you had set this up. So I ended up being called up to my lessons all over the school, all these days to teach them. Set this up and you go, oh yes, I said, it's very easy, back to front of the library.
There you go. The early days of technology in the history classroom. And I'm just going to finish off with Darren. Darren Huff, he works in Hartlepool in the North East. It was really nice to go up to that part of the country. It's not completely different. The history's the same in both places, but just a little flavour of different areas. And Darren teaches in quite a challenging school. He's a real enthusiast. And I interviewed him and I asked him, what was your favourite lesson, Darren? What do you really like teaching? And he told me, with actions. So I'll just play him in right at the end. Two, six. So you're going to go right through to the end. So last question to him. What was your favourite
lesson? Hello. I don't put the ball getting started here.
Oh, just a minute. He's talking about GCSE sort of obsession, isn't it? There we are.
Come through, I think. Hard and weird.
Just ignore the same bit.
Down on English. If you really compare that, you can't compare. And as a result, the subjects lose their status until they abandon.
Oh, is it in classroom? The pupil comes in and asks for something.
Just to finish off, if you could choose any subject to teach, what would it be?
My favourite topic to teach, I would honestly say, would be the ballet of DSM. I enjoy that because the kids are enthusiastic right at the beginning of DSM. I also think it's a topic that you can get your teeth into. You are good guys. Gabby Penn there.
Yeah,
you've got them very, very early. You've also got a case of something very sort of the other way. You've got good guys, you've got bad guys. You get historical skills in straight away. You get the chronology. You get everything in early. And I always do my running up and down the classroom a bit in there. I think it's a very easy topic when I'm doing the Battle of Hastings.
How do you mean,
running
up and down the classroom?
Well, I'll tell the story about the Battle of Hastings. Oh, where they're marching up on horses. Flashing against the shield wall. That type of thing. And it gets the kids enthused. And you can actually, we end up doing an essay on why people are running the Battle of Hastings. And it gets them straight up doing an essay skills, which is what you need to get the higher levels.
It's not that obsession with getting the higher levels, but you know, it's great, he's doing the actions and everything, and you can just imagine him doing the actions with the children. So that is, you know, this continuation of really good storytelling in the classroom today. So stop there, because we're going to have time for a few questions.
Just to remind you that Nicola introduced the website with a phrase that will resonate through the assistant teacher. She said it will be finished by Christmas.
Yes.
So, we've got a few minutes for any questions, questions, contributions on the archive that Nicola and Jenny just introduced. Is there any more pitching? Yes.
I can just say that, I mean, you presented wing interpretation, a story interpretation, but what you've actually got there is an Enneagram exercise, in which you have atomized it down to the reality of individuals, teachers and learners in different situations, adapting to the circumstances in which they find themselves, and doing things in the way that they think will best achieve the short-term goal of keeping the class in order, of getting the higher grade because the head's saying you've got to, and not to read that in or whatever it is. So, I mean, then you've got to establish a pattern, which doubtless the book has done. But it seems to me, my view is you've gone about it the right way.
Well, not me, but Nicola and Jenny.
That's a relief.
Well, just that's, I mean, I think we were, Nicola and I were very conscious from the beginning that we wanted to get over what was really happening in the classroom. There's so much that's written about this tradition from the top downwards and government policy, but what was actually happening? So I think to some extent, not totally, we do get over through all this evidence what people were actually learning. But having said that, another thing we learned was that every school is different, every teacher teaches in a different way. It's very hard to generalise about what pupils' experience in the classroom has been. And I hope that this morning person took that away.
Two people right at the back, and then the gentleman in the back.
Survey evidence adds to depth as well.
I was saying, to the anecdotal, if you like, that occurs in the interviews.
Yeah. Were you relieved that you were able to stop at the year 2000? If you'd had to take on board the next decade, would you have seen a vast change in methodology?
We did go to 2010. Sorry, it should be on, it's on the front of the book, isn't it? You can say 2010. Actually, within the covers of the book, it makes it clear we did go up to the current day. So, I don't think the last 10 years. I mean, there are trends. David pointed to some of the difficulties in interpreting what's been going on in the last 10 years. But I think it does get more difficult as you get closer to the current day. But important things have happened in the first decade of the 21st century. So I think. We try to reflect those in the final bit of the last chronological chapter, and then David, of course, in his conclusion, addresses contemporary issues very forcefully as newspapers reporting.
Anything else from that? Yeah.
I just wondered how much the survey of teachers showed that either the kind of public debate that Professor Kennedy told us on perennial influence teaching, or the kind of intellectual controversies among academic historians, whether there's any reflection of that in the classroom. Whether you found, for example, the problematic view of imperialism, which presumably has changed in the last few years, does that show up in the way people teach it?
I think there is some evidence of that. The one that springs to mind is the recent Holocaust development program, which the Holocaust is known by teachers as being a peculiar topic. I don't mean peculiar odd, I mean peculiar in itself. It's a sort of sui generis topic because it carries a load of other things with it in addition to wanting to teach an important historical topic, and teachers are very aware of that. But I think what's happened is that because there's been debates in the wider media, that has filtered into the classroom. So that's an example of it. And also, I think the diversity, ethnic and cultural diversity of this country, those sort of issues in the general culture do impact on the sort of preferences that the teachers show in their selection of topics and in the way they present it, and they filter through to textbooks and resources as well. You can see that actually right through. Even if I go back into the 1950s, there's evidence of teachers taking on board the fact that the empires are in a post-colonial period and then wanting to teach the Commonwealth. So teachers, I think history teachers, have a really good current affairs awareness, which then filters into what they want to do.
In a moment, I'm going to hand over to Jenny, who's going to say something to conclude the morning. I just want to say, by way of concluding the formal part of this session, thank you very much for a really fascinating introduction to what is a resource that I know everybody in this room can enjoy themselves exploring to their heart's content. I also want to say, sitting here, it is a remarkable experience. Rather like the last chapter of Mort D'Arvor, that there is, sitting in this room, an extraordinary collection